Welcome to the Reasoned Roundtable, the weekly libertarian podcast from the magazine that only characterizes Americans as vermin when we're talking about the great vermin supreme. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Top of the week, everyone.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Eeyore, when are you going to snap out of it, for crying out loud? Jesus. Didn't we all just do this, by the way, like 36 hours ago or something?
Yes, but I think from our listeners' perspective, they don't know that yet.
36 hours in the future.
That's a tease.
It's a time heist podcast today, guys.
Well, will you clarify the tease a little bit, Matt, so it just doesn't sound like we're...
It's like a Quentin Tarantino script from the early 1990s. It's all out of order, but it makes sense in the end.
He just refurbished the Vista Theater, which is my neighborhood theater back in the day. So, we recorded a special bonus episode on Saturday in the brand spanking new Reason DC headquarters in front of a couple score of our dearest friends and colleagues and countrymen. And it was great. And we'll release it later on this week. That's it. Let's now talk about the elections and debates and various political things that happened last week. In fact, we'll talk about that in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsors and friends at Donors Trust, the principled and tax-friendly way to simplify your charitable giving. Friends, even as we speak, left-wing mega donors are shoveling money into pet projects that do not reflect American values. In extremely related news, lawmakers continue to push bloated big government policies like so-called student loan cancellation that are guaranteed to raise prices and fail to reach the people they are meant to help. All is not lost, however. You can help turn the tide with a charitable giving account at Donors Trust. Donors Trust is a refuge from the storm of progressive philanthropy and big government shenanigans that damage our institutions and frankly hurt our loved ones by helping you maximize the positive impact of your giving while minimizing your tax liability. Win-win. Whether it's defending free speech, funding alternatives to government-run education, or fighting green energy extremists, Donors Trust is the charitable giving account provider for you. Just visit www.donorstrust.org/reason to learn more. That's www.donorstrust.org/reason to learn more about minimizing your tax liability and maximizing your giving. Visit donorstrust.org/reason today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. People love to blah, blah, blah about future elections, especially the one that's happening in 12 months on the national level. But in the meantime, we had actual real life elections in this country as recently as last week. There were three, I think, gubernatorial elections in Kentucky, Mississippi, and Louisiana that went Dem hold, GOP hold, and Republican flip, respectively. I know you're keeping score at home. We had four state legislative elections, including a disappointing day for Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin's attempt to turn Virginia more red. We had ballot propositions in a handful of states, including most notably legal weed and abortion rights in Ohio, which was
Were separate initiatives, Matt, just to make it clear.
Were they, though? Which we're going to get into that. We even had a libertarian mayor elected in Wichita, Kansas, which is a city. It's a big one, sort of. So congratulations to Lily Wu. There's a bunch of individual storylines, including some of those mentioned already, that we will explore pretty shortly. But Peter, are there any like macro through lines? Is there a rug of an explanation that's tying the room together here, politically speaking?
Oh, yeah. And I definitely feel like I just got, tossed across my living room and into the toilet. Why am I saying this? I don't know where I'm going with this because it's a Big Lebowski reference and we believe in nothing, Lebowski. Okay. So the takeaway here is the Democrats came out of this feeling very confident, and they felt very confident because once again, they performed well and arguably even overperformed the expected fundamentals. And this election, they performed well in a time at which, as we've discussed on this podcast, voters are really down on Joe Biden and the Joe Biden economy, and they blame Joe Biden for their sense of declining economic fortunes or stagnating economic fortunes. And so Democrats look at these election results and they say, hey, you know what? actually were doing pretty well. And the same thing happened in 2022. So you know what? We don't really have to worry about 2024. Well, maybe. I mean, 2024 election is a year out from now, and many, many things can happen. But I think if you actually take a closer, more granular look at the polls, Democrats don't have a Democrat problem. The party isn't in trouble in a kind of broad sense. Joe Biden is in trouble because voters blame Joe Biden for the feeling they have that their economic fortunes are declining or stagnating. And I mean, there's just poll after poll now showing this. There was an FT poll that came out within the last couple of days that showed that something like only 14% of voters feel like they are better off under Joe Biden. Very, very few actually think his policies have made anything better. Most think that the largest portion of voters think that things have gotten worse specifically because of his policies. If you think of the general economic situation as the biggest single thing that people are likely to vote on, which makes sense because, you know what, that's the, if you want to sort of pick a number about like, how are you doing? How do you feel about yourself and your life and your country? The economy is the one number that you're going to pick, right? Or the one metric, the kind of thing that it's going to be judged on. And it just looks like, I think Democrats are probably going to come out of this a little bit too confident in their ability to take on Donald Trump, most likely in 2024.
Nick, one of the big interpretive takeaways about the election afterwards is that abortion is like this magical get out the vote card for Democrats and radioactive poison for Republicans. What say you?
Well, looking specifically at the Ohio initiative, which had to overcome a previous attempt to kind of make it harder for it to even be on the ballot, which it went handily. But the initiative, which enshrines in the Constitution of Ohio a right to an abortion until essentially viability. So it's much more expansive than the law that was on the books that was being held up from 2000, whenever, that essentially banned almost all abortions except for the life of the mother. But it passed 56-44%. It did extremely well. And this also a slight, basically every other state where it's been on the ballot, it has done well. And, you know, people talked about Kansas a couple of years ago, a very red state that overwhelmingly supported maintaining abortion rights. Ohio, it's a little bit more complicated, but it's mostly a red state. And certainly Trump won it very easily. And across almost all the demographics, it was very much in favor of abortion. And I think what this comes down to is not that people are in favor of abortion, they're in favor of abortion rights. And that the Republicans miscalculated on what they thought people wanted, or rather, actually, I don't even think it's that. It's just that they're out of step with what people want. And as a result, they keep going down to defeat. Whenever this happens, there's a good chance that Florida will actually work to kind of enshrine more abortion rights than somebody like Ron DeSantis is calling for right now as well.
Catherine, you're a lady. Tell us about Lady Lily Wu in Wichita, and you can say something about abortions if you want to as well.
Thank you so much for that permission.
But keep it short. Yeah, he's the male host has given you permission to speak about.
Thank you. Truly, women's rights have been accomplished. You know, I really do not enjoy the way that the abortion coverage around this election was framed as like, well, yeah, reproductive rights are in shambles. But on the upside, that fact means Democrats win elections. Like there's way too much of that tone in a lot of the coverage. And it's like, first of all,
but it's okay because they're more likely to abort future, you know, current Democratic voters who support abortion are more likely to abort future Democratic voters who would support abortion. So
actually, this is a Republican win. Is that?
I think so. This is the type of, you know, kind of future analysis I think we'll be getting into shortly.
Thank you, Nick, for bringing us to the next level. I mean, it literally in the New York Times in their kind of big election roundup piece, one of the subheads is "There's nothing like abortion to aid Democrats." That's a headline, and it's like. Yuck. Yuck if you like abortion. Yuck if you don't like abortion. Yuck if you just don't like Democrats. It's not great. So I do want to flag that. But on a happier distaff note, yeah, we got this like lady who seems pretty libertarian in Wichita. I wish that I could have said, like, I really had my eye on this up-and-coming 39-year-old libertarian lady who's out here winning office. I had not heard of her before Election Day, but Reason's own Eric Boehm interviewed her after her victory. I will note that the Libertarian Party is being moderately churlish about her. They sort of...
Wait, libertarians?
they're on their best behavior, is what you're saying.
Honestly, yes. Yeah. Eric does characterize the statement of the chairman of the Libertarian Party of Kansas as the more diplomatic of the statements when he said that the LP will, quote, be watching closely and loudly. Bless their hearts. But she did. She is a registered libertarian. And in her interview with Eric, she says very explicitly, like, I'm a libertarian. I believe in freedom. I believe in personal responsibility. I don't like the hyperpolarization. She also does kind of seem to like cops, although she seems to like cops from the perspective of like, hey, it would be cool if we had the amount of cops that our budget says we're supposed to have. And those cops did their jobs. You know, theoretically, that is compatible with libertarianism. We'll see. We'll see. I also will be watching closely and loudly, but that is my job.
Is it now dicta that libertarians are anti-cop?
No, but I didn't say you had to be anti-cop. I think the call to hire more police officers is not always and everywhere incompatible with libertarianism, but it should raise some little orange flags. Just keeping an eye on what's going on. Otherwise, though, she does have a good rap about economic liberty and personal freedom and what it means to be an immigrant. And I like all of that.
There are cop shortages all over the country. Some are for whatever reasons of attrition, but others are that the profession was made less attractive, especially after 2020.
There are everything shortages of many government positions, but sometimes that's because you need more of those. And sometimes it's because actually it was all wildly overestimated, overbudgeted, and we don't need any of these jerks in their offices. So could be either in Wichita. I don't know because I don't live there.
Speaking of cops, Peter, tell us about what cops won't be able to enforce anymore in Ohio.
In Ohio, voters approved a ballot initiative to legalize recreational marijuana. It's going to allow possession, home cultivation, commercial distribution. Basically, you can buy it, you can sell it, and you can own it, and you can smoke it. That is, at least if state legislators don't interfere. The way that the ballot initiatives work in Ohio is that the Congress basically has the opportunity to sort of rework and rewrite. Some of the Republicans have made noise suggesting that they might do something along those lines, although it's not totally clear. But I think... forgetting what the GOP Congress in Ohio may or may not do here, this is a really kind of remarkable sign. Even though this is the 24th state to legalize marijuana, in some ways we're used to it at this point. But I want to say this is the moment at which libertarians can feel like we really won here, right? Because one of the biggest reasons given was just that they wanted to get their laws in line with the states around them. And so, what does that tell you? In a very red state, voters are looking at pot legalization happening just over their borders, and they're saying, yes, that's good. We want that. We want to be the same as those other states. But the other thing that this reminds me of is, you guys, maybe even better than me, remember the Cold War and Vietnam?
Maybe.
Oh, yeah.
And there was this thing that like Cold War hawks had this idea.
Part of me didn't make it back from Vietnam, Peter.
There was.
And it's not over. Nothing is over.
We're going to have to install some rules here, like bowling in the Big Lebowski. There was this idea that Hawks had that proved to be wrong, but it was called domino theory, which was that if you knock over the authoritarians in one place and prop up a democracy, it'll just spread all over the world, and then eventually we'll all have kind of Western style democracies everywhere. Well, that didn't work with the wars, but it is work with losing the drug war. We are losing the drug war like drugs are winning the drug war, and they are winning in part via domino theory, because just the critical mass of states that have already set up legalization regimes are helping to make it possible to fill in the gaps in other states, even states that politically you might not expect to want to go ahead with legalized marijuana.
Is this cultural Marxism?
Ooh.
Butterfly meme guy.
You heard the butterfly meme guy in my voice.
The marijuana policy project, if I may, just with the Ohio vote, now 52% of Americans live in a state, you know, with recreational pot. So that might be a tipping point. You know, it's a majority.
It's amazing. It was literally, what, 10 years ago, Nick, that we had the first statewide ballot initiative that came close in California and lost.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, a lot of the, pretty professional marijuana organizations, and Nick and I write about this in our book, The Declaration of Independence,
Bingo.
How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. Bingo, but also it was for me, not Nick. But that was brought to the ballot in California against the wishes, against the normal practices of the typical legalization.
Stoner pothead, who, of course, couldn't get off the couch to prevent an initiative from being put on the ballot in their cause. But
it's amazing to see. I'm very happy about all of that. I am going to, well, actually, Peter's Cold War take about the domino theory is that it was less about like the freedom countries are going to domino. It was more about like, if we don't hold the line in Vietnam, then they're coming for us in all these other
Laos,
countries.
Here. Cambodia, Thailand. Burma.
In fact, there's a just Google or a search on the recent search engine, Domino Theory, Matt Welch and John McCain, and you will see some interesting work about that.
As someone who beat some of her unnamed Reason colleagues in Risk this weekend, I just want to say Domino Theory can be real.
Matt, is that the article that you suggested an alternative Mahjong theory?
The Go theory.
I mean, why? Domino theory, like, obviously wasn't going to explain very much when nobody played dominoes anymore. You know, it's like the tiddlywink.
The real domino theory is about pizza delivery.
Mm.
Before we leave Ohio, if I may just say.
We're never leaving this place.
No, I left successfully in 2018. But, you know, Ohio is the most normal of normal states. It's still a place where fast food, particularly in Columbus, Ohio, go to try out new stuff. And one of the other things buried in the exit polls coming out of Ohio was that only 25% of people in Ohio want Biden to run for president. It's a state that Trump won by like 6 or 8 points. Only 33% want Trump to run for president. And what's amazing about this, back in 2016, we wrote a lot about this at Reason about how absolutely contemptible most voters found both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. We are reaching a different level of, you know, kind of annoyance and frustration. And what's interesting this time, it's not even about their personalities. It is about their very existences because everybody thinks they're too old. And Biden has had a shot. And, you know, as Peter was saying earlier on, people dislike him. They blame him for why their life sucks. That may be wrong on their part, but it's important to factor in. And Trump had 4 years, you know, and people hate him now too. And how this plays out, I think, is really the biggest wild card, because it's clear Democrats can win or Republicans win independent of who's on the ticket, but it's going to be those two guys, and everybody is voting. Yeah, everybody is rooting against both of them.
Let's talk about that in as a segue into related news, right? Last week, as well, Senator Joe Manchin, the centrist Democrat from deep red West Virginia, and a thorn in the side to power-gobbling progressives, announced Thursday that he would not seek re-election next year, and also that he would be, quote, traveling the country and speaking out to see if there is an interest in creating a movement to mobilize the middle.
So he's finally achieving his hobo dream as a child growing up
ride
in West
the
Virginia.
Rails with
yeah,
with
the
bindle.
Little bindle. Yeah, it's like, what an ass. You know, it's like he has been in Congress. You know, he's been in power for like 1,000 years, but now he's going to go find out what people actually fucking need or want.
Let's let Matt finish. The math on this, to remind everyone, is that currently there's a 51-49 majority of the Democratic Party. The Democrat Party in the Senate. So if you just took Manchin alone and his effect of leaving the race in 2024, that's almost guaranteed to flip it to 50-50. And the same day that he announced his retirement, he also did a little joint press conference unveil-y thingy with the also retiring Republican centristy Senator Mitt Romney from Utah, Mittens, in which they hawked their Fiscal Stability Act, a so-called bipartisan solution to strengthen America's fiscal health and stabilize our nation's finances for future generations by creating a bicameral fiscal commission tasked with finding legislative solutions to stabilize and decrease our national debt, end quote. In a remarkable coincidence, just the day before that, there was a new political advocacy group that filed with the Federal Elections Commission called the Draft Romney Manchin Committee, whose backers told the Deseret News, oh, Deseret, wouldn't it be great to go to the polls and actually feel good about the choices that you have instead of the lesser of two evils, Nick Gillespie? Peter, I know that you have a Joe Manchin throw pillar on your throw pillow. Throw pillar? We need some throw pillars around here in the new office. On your dog couch, what is the significance of all the Manchin activity, and what is his legacy?
To be clear, I have Pulp Fiction and Star Wars throw pillars.
Yes.
Pillars? Okay. Pillows?
Wow, you guys, what's happening right now?
It's Monday, man.
Do you have the whole Jar Jar Binks like bedroom set, Peter? Or
oh, no, but I've always really wanted the Tauntaun that you can sleep in.
Is there like a sleeping bag?
Yes, it's a sleeping bag that you zip, the belly zips open.
Yeah,
it's the greatest
now too.
Tie-in product
that would be great.
Ever. And Joe Manchin and Mitt Romney are the second greatest crossover in political. No, I don't know. So look, I have said that I feel like I was a little bit wrong about Mitt Romney. I have said some nice things about Joe Manchin on this podcast before. They are not libertarians. Let's start there. They're really not libertarians. They are often difficult, often frustrating. They have a bunch of bad ideas between them. At the same time, you know what they are? They're kind of normal and not awful. Like, they're a little weird at times, for sure. And Manchin in particular, like if you've ever, so because I live in Washington, at times I've had the opportunity to be in rooms with him, sort of small groups in conversation. He's so likable, and he's also...
Men's rooms, mostly, public restrooms.
This is what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps, Nick.
Yeah.
and he's very likable. He's very likable, but he's also... You can just see that he has not made up his mind about absolutely anything until like the moment in which he has like he's just running a kind of super sensitive survey of like where the middle of his voters are like at any given moment. And like and there's just that he sort of has this weird instinctive ability to kind of land at the exact, you know, 50.1% middle ground for things. But it's not there's no principle behind it. There's no systematic thinking behind it. There's nothing that's like, oh, this is what you can count on him to do because he's consistent and he really believes in it, except he kind of believes in being decent and finding that 50% plus one sweet spot for the American voter.
And whatever he thinks will help West Virginia to get more federal dollars.
That is correct. But it's for his voters, right? I mean, so yeah. I should say, I should be more clear. It is, Manchin is doing that for West Virginia in particular, with an eye toward the nation as a whole. And Romney has done not exactly the same thing. Instead, Romney has tried to play the kind of, you know, moral, the conscience of the Republican Party during the Trump era, which has often been good and useful. He has said a lot of stuff that I agree with. Yet, as you pointed out, Matt, in your excellent piece on McKay Cobbins' book on Romney, that wasn't always his way. In fact, where Romney comes from is the consulting world, where a lot of what your job is to do is to just sort of say back to your client the thing that they said, except a little slicker and in bullet points. And that was kind of his approach to running for president for all of those years. And so in some ways, these guys are like a perfect match, right? They're the Marvels. Sorry,
accurate and totally cruel comparison
of like American centrism, which is to say that, you know, in theory, like this should be a big blockbuster. On the other hand, it's not at all clear that anybody wants it if you look at the numbers from this weekend.
Nick, is the politician, let's form a bipartisan debt commission move, the politician equivalent of the rock critic judgment that a classic rock act has returned to form on their latest album that sucks?
I do. I'm looking forward to Romney driving around the country with Joe Manchin in a dog box on top of his car. I think that would be great.
The way that you are committed to that news tidbit from the dark age, like, it's hilarious. I'm not, you're not wrong.
Yeah, I know. Like what has Mitt Romney done to dislodge that as the thing he should be remembered for?
I mean, Pierre Delecto. I think he should be remembered forever as Pierre Delecto, which was his Twitter, gnome to Twitter account. And just the mind that comes up with, that's my alter ego, is Pierre Delecto.
On the other hand, the kids can relate to that because everybody's got an alt these days, right?
Sure. That's his Finsta.
Yeah, Pierre Delecto. I mean, that's up there with Rod Mexico. And what were the other? I mean, there was like that weird moment where people were outed with ridiculous.
The New Republic critic who was posting under his own articles as Sprezzatura.
That was Lee something, right?
I mean, you know, all of us have an AOL screen name somewhere in our past. So just
but we
careful.
Don't sock puppet. I wrote a piece about that guy who then, of course, got laundered again. It was titled Sock Puppetry of the Penis. Because it was all about how good looking he was. You know, it's like, in any case, to go back to Matt's going to probably shit on No Labels for good reason, not just because his body is breaking down, but I like commissions. I like debt commissions that are actually pushed by the president or somebody or Congress or something like that. You know, going back to the Simpson-Bowles one that Obama put into play and then ignored the minute that they actually produced something. But I went back and looked at, you know, they made the rounds of various TV shows and they helped keep the conversation about debt in people's minds, right? And in conversation and things like that, which doesn't, you know, help like getting from a bunch of old guys. And we've talked about this in the past when Alan Simpson, you know, started talking about the Enema Man and Snoopy poop pants and, you know, like why kids don't write their grandparents thank you notes. Having said all of that, like we would really benefit from somebody somewhere in power kind of foregrounding debt issues, because this is, you know, all of the stuff that we're talking about. And, you know, Catherine, if you played Risk, it's like, we're all talking about, and I'm trying to remember, like, is it Yakutsk or Irkutsk? Like, one of them is, like, not really important at all. The other one has, like, kind of like a, it's on the frontier, and you can get into Alaska or something like that. But, like, you know, the debt and spending issues really are gigantic, and nobody is talking about them anymore. So, to the extent that we can get a commission that will bring that back, and if it has to be Joe Manchin and Mitt Romney, that would be great.
No Labels talking about them will not change the status quo as you just described it. Like,
probably. You know, where it might is simply that No Labels has a couple of billionaires who are invested in it, and somehow, and you get enough of them talking about something, and maybe it will start coming up again. You know, it's very dismaying. We need to be foregrounding, you know, issues of debt and spending.
I mostly agree with Nick here. The case against debt commissions is that we've had them and they haven't worked
our debt
at all.
Still do be debt
before, right? Like, look at the debt. Look at the deficit. Yeah. It hasn't worked before. On the other hand, the case for debt commissions is first that other types of commissions have worked. And in particular, everyone's favorite example in Washington for so many years was BRAC. The Base Realignment and Closing Commission, which did in fact successfully close a bunch of military bases, allowed the military to do some realignment there, gave them flexibility, probably saved some money relative to the trajectory we would have been on, which is not the same as the Pentagon budget got smaller in real dollar terms, but probably was ultimately good both for the flexibility of the military and for it was better at least. Which is not to say good, but better.
And spawned a memorable episode of The West Wing.
Indeed.
A whole episode of a genuinely popular blockbuster TV show that was centered around the drama
of closing, I think it was Norton Air Force Base in New York.
I mean, I am delighted to report that I don't remember the specifics, but that I was like spellbound by the Breck episode of West Wing, along with the rest of America.
As I recall, there were some New York legislators who were very upset about this because they thought that the West Wing doing a Breck episode about their base might result in the closure of their base.
There's a real case to be made that the West Wing as a phenomenon has in fact resulted in our current branch of the timeline. So I don't think that's so far off.
The other thing to say about bipartisan debt commissions is that, yes, in the past they haven't worked, but nothing else has in terms of doing significant amounts, doing, you know, making a significant net in the deficit and the debt. And so you have to have something, and you're going to have something that has some kind of bipartisan bias. This really is true, and that means that there are going to be compromises. There are going to be things that probably people on this podcast don't like. At the same time, if you don't have some number of Democrats and Republicans on board with this, then even if you could pass something, say, with a bare Republican majority that did, in theory, reduce the debt over the next 20 or 30 years, Democrats would reverse it immediately the next time they took office. And so you've got to get bipartisan buy-in here. And this is a good first step, even if, yes, in the past, it has not worked super well.
Catherine, you're a no votes, but what is your overall take at this late date to no labels? Are we going to feel the no labels momentum here sometime soon?
I feel some level of gratitude that a Manchin-Romney or Romney-Manchin ticket at least would spare us a anybody plus John Huntsman ticket, which continues to haunt and bedevil us all in this world. Yeah, I mean, I like the vibes of the no labels people, but I think, you know, where we started this conversation is right, which is that there is a difference between I am against the bullshit that the two major parties are up to, and I am a libertarian. And no labels is that difference. Like, they are correct to be against the absolute nonsense of the two major parties. And they will be correct to note, I assume repeatedly, and whoever, whatever microphone gets shoved in their faces, that neither Trump nor Biden would be a good president. But they will not, like, no labels does not get us substantially closer, I don't think, to the world we want to see, which is a world of smaller government and more personal freedom. That's not the business of either Mitt Romney or Joe Manchin, even if occasionally their agenda overlaps with ours.
I think that you will never go broke betting against the positive libertarian impacts of Vinegar Joe Lieberman, who is the sort of titular head behind no labels right now. He's rarely good news for those of us who believe in smaller government and maybe not quite as many U.S.-led wars abroad. All right. Let's go to our listener email of the week here, slightly belatedly. This one comes from Jim Watson. Reminder to everyone to email your brief queries, as always, to roundtable@reason.com. And just to tease up, in a couple of weeks, we're going to be having our annual Reason Webathon here, which means another bonus episode in which you will be answering to all your emails and insults and whatnot. So get ready, stay tuned at this station. Get ready to loosen both your wallet and your lips. This one, as I said before, comes from Jim Watson. He writes, Reason Roundtable Wise People. Okay, that's how that works. With less than a year.
I'll set this one out.
Yeah. You might, actually. With less than a year of the 2024 general election, why haven't we heard from the National Libertarian Party about its platform and who is running for president? Waiting until the party holds its presidential nominating convention in May, only 6 months from the election, doesn't appear to be a winning strategy. Not enough time or resources to get the message out, especially in a year where a viable Libertarian Party candidate can have a major impact on the election. Signed, Jim, and then in parentheses, Jimmy Reliable. Watson, Jimmy Reliable. Nick, you have strong feels about,
you know,
this.
What say you? Jimmy has to say he's reliable and he's covering something up.
It should be this unspoken. Like,
yeah, I believed it until I heard him claim it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the LP is going to be choosing its candidate, its official candidate, in late May. A big problem for the party. And it did not always used to be this way, but it has been for quite some time. I remember talking to Nicholas Sarwark, the former chair of the LP party about this. And he was like, hey, you know, that's how they decided to do it. I think just from a pragmatic point of view, it would make sense to get the nominee set like a year before the election, if not more, because the LP, with the possible exception of Gary Johnson, the Gary Johnson William Weld ticket, which did the best ever, there's never name recognition for an LP candidate. So you're not only trying to introduce a candidate in a race, but then also the LP party platform. I think the LP has been pretty clear about what they believe in, things like ending the Fed, ending all wars. The biggest issue, of course, is releasing the Epstein client list. Why hasn't that been released yet, Matt? You know, what are you afraid of, Matt, with that?
So but much.
It's a tactical error, I think, in a gigantic way for a third party. It would make so much more sense for them to do it sooner.
So the thinking, as far as I remember from covering the LP over the years, is that when you do it in the May of the election year, first of all, you get a lot more attention during election year. That's when, including from libertarians themselves. It's always presidential years that you get the most donations, that you get the most party memberships, and et cetera. You can also choose your candidate at that convention as a counterpunch, because by May of an election year, you're going to know pretty much who the major party nominees are. That was wrapped up last time on May 3rd after the Indiana, not last time, but in 2016, when Donald Trump had become, Joe Biden had sewn his up by April, I believe, of 2020. So they can counterpunch, they can raise more money, at least that's the thinking. And then also, you know, if you decide this a year in advance, then this is like super low interest, low intensity moment of people vying for an election. So it's kind of easier for some absolute rando to come in if they like throw money at the problem or whatever. I don't know which is better, but
I think the record of, you know, the LP doing well kind of speaks for itself, really. You know, then do it in January or something, but it's insane. And when you look at the people who are left standing for the LP nomination this year, and this says nothing about them as individuals or even as candidates, nobody has heard of any of them.
That's not true now. At least libertarians have heard of Jacob Hornberger, longtime writer and thinker, and he was basically the runner-up for the presidential nomination last time around, a big anti-war guy. Chase Oliver has at least some moderate recognition as someone who kind of forced two different Georgia elections to go into a runoff, running for Senate and running for Congress. And just because I should, I'll name the other four people running who indeed no one could pick out of a police lineup unless they're hardcore libertarian insiders. But that's Joshua Smith, Michael Rechtenwald, Lars Mapstead, best name out there, I think, so far, and Mike Termott. Certain kind of Dutch name. But those are the guys running. They had a debate just this past weekend in South Carolina. And go follow all of that stuff if you're interested in it. I think I'm going to take an executive decision unless Catherine and Peter have a burning itch to weigh in. I would like to sneak in our last lightning round. Any objections? So noted. We're going to go straight on to it. There was a GOP presidential debate last week. And the best news coming out of it is that one of the five people on stage quit. Sorry, Senator Tim Scott. He seems like a nice guy. I kind of liked him. We didn't have enough time to get excited about it. But anyways, we will talk, because we have talked on the future bonus episode, about some of the foreign policy aspects of those candidates during that debate. So let's just go around for a quick lightning round here of anything else to take away out of that debate from last week. Catherine, why don't you start off?
So we watched the debate last week here in the new DC office. And one thing that I was struck by was the absolute lack of fire in the eyes of Tim Scott, which was then validated by him appearing to announce his departure from the race, according to tweets that are circulating right now, to the surprise of his staff. In real time, a couple of days later. There's just something about him as a candidate that never really looked like it was going to go anywhere. But I will miss, I suppose, his relative calm on the stage. We are now going to sort of be into the full-fledged rabid dogs only period of the campaign, and that's unfortunate for the party. Of course, none of those people are very likely to get the nomination unless there is an actuarial intervention in which Donald Trump is somehow unable to run for president.
Peter, what's a takeaway that you had?
Several Republican presidential wannabes actually said, hey, maybe we should do something about the fact that Social Security, and I guess Medicare too, but mostly Social Security, is about to run out of money. They didn't say exactly what we should do. The closest you got to an actual plan was Chris Christie saying, you know, if you're super freaking rich like Warren Buffett, maybe you shouldn't take Social Security, which actually, I think he even said, like, shame on you, Warren Buffett, if you are taking it. And as much as I think that the wealthiest of the wealthy should not be getting Social Security, I actually don't blame them for taking it, not only because they are entitled to it, but because if you choose not to, it's a very difficult legal process to get out of it, and then it causes a bunch of other problems for you. This was an acknowledgement that Social Security is not going to have enough money to pay all of its bills relatively soon. And maybe, just maybe, the nation's political class should start kind of, sort of, thinking about some way to do something about that.
Nick, what was one takeaway you had?
That Nikki Haley kind of was starting to sound out a GOP ability to accommodate abortion rights. That, to me, is fascinating. Also, that these kind of losers are starting to at least address the issue of we need to have a candidate who is not Donald Trump because he won't win.
And Nikki Haley has been saying that exact thing on abortion rights during all the debates. But I do think each time she says it, a new kind of tranche of people notice that it sounds really actually fairly sensible.
If the GOP is defined as the party that cares ultimately, you know, at the top of its issue list is that we have to ban all abortion or virtually all abortion, et cetera. They're just, it's a party that will be getting, you know, 25-30% of the vote.
Because there's nothing like abortion to aid Democrats.
That's right. That's right. And unborn children.
I enjoyed Tim Scott dropping out, and I look forward to, although I don't have any sense that he will yet, when Chris Christie drops out, because why is he running? He's not going to win, and Nikki Haley's beating him in that thing, that category, or that lane, so get out. And I would normally say that I look forward for Vivek Ramaswamy to drop out, because just generally I do. He's becoming very irritating. But can we just, like, close our eyes for a second and imagine the near future? Imagine Christie drops out, all right? Imagine that instead of five people on the stage, it's just, for the sake of argument, Ron DeSantis decides to step down too. He's not going to, but I just want a Vivek versus Nikki Haley debate, because she hates him so much. Just imagine them hating each other on stage for like 90 minutes would be absolutely delicious and beautiful. No, it's really good. I think that that the field is narrowing, so we can get on with it. Like, are we really going to do this? I presume it's going to get pretty brutal between Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis going forward. And maybe through mostly her throwing of sharp elbows on this and just kind of like seeming to know who she is, which is it's a quality that Trump voters could potentially like, because you need to peel off Trump voters if you're going to win the nomination. So far, the beginning, DeSantis was the only one of the field who seemed to get, besides Ramaswamy, but to seem to get both normie and Trump votes. If Nikki Haley can do that, I think she could be a more compelling candidate than DeSantis has been so far. I think he's run a really desultory campaign.
But is she, I mean, is there anything in this, and I mean this seriously, for, you know, for us as libertarians, what in this process and in this half of the, you know, of the political race for president, is there anything good coming out of this? Because the Republican Party just really seems to be so unmoored from anything approaching, you know, even the libertarian rhetoric that they used to espouse on a fairly regular basis a decade ago.
Haley, as we've written, has actually talked seriously about Republicans have their fingerprints over jacking up government spending, and that's a bad thing. So I'm happy to hear that. And I'm happy that she's not a race baiter. She gave one of the best speeches of the 21st centuries, political speeches, when she talked about the Confederate flag coming down over South Carolina. And she's not Donald Trump. So those are the
all y'all joining me. I was early on the maybe Nikki Haley isn't the worst thing that ever happened bandwagon. And here you are. Obviously, next week she will be saying but my on day one, I'm murdering all the libertarians and then we can be done here.
Yeah,
but,
and then on day two, she'll self-deport because you know, course, America for Americans or something. Well,
let's always remember, all politicians are garbage and will disappoint you in the end. Keep it in mind.
Speaking of the end, let's go to our end of podcast, what we've been consuming in the cultural arena. Nick, why don't you start us off?
So I've been looking at an incredible thing called the Bitcoin Coffee Table Book by Eric Freeberg. It's available on Amazon. It is volume zero, and it is a giant coffee table book of a variety, beautifully designed and laid out. Satoshi's early emails and various versions of both the code that is at the very base of Bitcoin, as well as emails and comments and tweets and things like that. And what is beautiful about it is Bitcoin is fantastic. It's interesting. It's always embattled. But most of all, it's completely intangible. I mean, you know, that's its secret power, is that, you know, Bitcoin enthusiasts will talk about how, you know, you can't carry millions of dollars in cash or coin. Not even Robert Menendez can pull this off with his trick suits filled with, you know, zipper pockets. But you can't walk across a border with all your cash, with all your belongings, which means you're trapped in a way, or your wealth is trapped in various places. But with Bitcoin, if you know your keys, you can be anywhere in the world and access your money as long as you have an internet connection. And what the Bitcoin Coffee Table Book does that is beautiful is it's just a tangible artifact of this incredibly powerful, intangible thing called Bitcoin that can be used everywhere but resides nowhere in physical space. So I really recommend, if you are a Bitcoin enthusiast, the Bitcoin Coffee Table Book is it's a beautiful thing. It's really wonderful. It's very calming and inspiring.
Peter, what garbage movie did you watch?
Well, I watched one garbage movie, which was The Marvels, and it was terrible. But what I really want to talk about is Pulp Fiction, a movie I have seen many times, but which I finally saw on the big screen this weekend at my local Alamo Drafthouse. The movie's tremendous, and the big screen presentation just emphasizes all the ways in which it is an all-timer. It also helps underscore how old this movie is. I mean, this is almost 30 years old now, so watching it today is like watching movies from the 1950s or 1960s when I was a kid. It just feels out of date, like it's from another time. And the movie's cultural context is so different in so many ways. The way it treats drugs and music, there's no, you know, obviously barely any cell phones. The idea of robbing a bank with a phone is like, wow, high tech, newfangled. And of course, all of the race stuff. I mean, Quentin Tarantino just dropping N-bombs all over this movie. Right. But also the physical landscape. And this is something that I actually want to run by you, Matt Welch, because the movie is in many ways a tour of various Los Angeles neighborhoods, from high end homes in the hills to low rent apartment complexes and kind of shabby middle class bungalows. And what struck me watching this was how all of these character dwellings that are supposed to be affordable middle class housing, those are like $4 million homes now. I mean, you got to be incredibly well off to live like a low rent drug dealer in 1992 in LA now. And it's just like it's a real trip and a kind of a way of time traveling back to when zoning had not screwed up the housing market nearly as much as it has. The other thing that stood out was just how good the scripting and acting, the script and acting are. This is a movie full of 10 out of 10 lines that are given 11 out of 10 delivery. The actors here are all great, and they're also at the top of their game. You get great quips, these kind of laconic back and forths. And so often the dialogue, the scenes resolve into these thundering, intense monologues, August Wilson style declarations of the self, right? In which the characters are elucidating a whole worldview in very entertaining fashion. And so just to lay out my own worldview here, this movie is, among other things, a reminder that the greatest unit of conversation is and has always been the elaborate monologue.
apparently.
I think that movie, that was almost as long as Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. To answer your question, Peter, the real estate market in Southern California crashed after a 40-year boom in the early 90s. It was cheap. Mm-hmm. Cheap to live there. And also everything horrible was happening in Southern California in the early 90s as well. I think it came out in 94. Great year for movies. Like top three or four. Just fantastic. Of which the best one is the name, one I can't remember the name of, Schwarzenegger, True Lies.
True Lies. Fantastic movie.
Just everyone go see it three times.
I consider that a Tom Arnold vehicle, Matt.
Absolutely.
Welch.
Absolutely. Yep. Catherine, what did you consider?
First, I just want to say Pulp Fiction is the only movie I was ever forbidden from seeing by my parents. Like, literally just that movie. I didn't have regular parents. I had cool parents. So this was generally not an issue. But we owned the maybe VHS tape of True Lies and watched it on the regular religiously. I did not see Pulp Fiction until I was significantly older because my dad saw it and it just like scared the pants off of him, I think, honestly.
Did occasion a long Peter Suderman-esque national dialogue about how awful movies have become, and also Miramax was being bought by Disney, and Disney was now a filth promoter, et cetera.
It was really the antitrust, anti-Pulp Fiction dialogue that we were about to return to.
Pulp Fiction was part of this, but Pulp Fiction was also a response to the way that Reservoir Dogs, even more so, had been held up, literally talked about in Congress as, you know, what are these corrupting forces of our kids, along with Mortal Kombat, by, to bring this back to our earlier conversation,
Joe Lieberman.
Joe Lieberman.
That's your job. I want to recommend a book that I haven't read yet, but I feel so serenely confident that it will be good. And I want you, listeners, to join me in your excitement about this book. There is a new book in the Murderbot Diaries coming out tomorrow. This is Martha Wells. She has written several novellas and then a slightly longer book, starring a just what it sounds like, a robot designed to do murder who accidentally caught feelings via watching TV and now goes on wacky adventures through the universe. These books are great. And I don't love them just because it's about a robot with a little bit of feelings, but not too many. I also love them because they are plotty and yet a little bit brainy. So System Collapse, book 7 in the Murderbot Diaries, out tomorrow. I will be reading it tomorrow, so sorry to my colleagues who might need me to edit their work. No deal.
Are you sure that you're not writing them under a pen name?
I'm Tyler Durdening.
About yourself.
I'm Tyler Durdening these books.
Sprezzatura-ing the Murderbot Diaries. You're just like, it would be too much if I just admitted.
I wish I was Martha Wells. I would throw all this away to be Martha Wells, but I'm not. So all I can do, Catherine, is read her books and enjoy them. You should do so as well.
So I read a book that we've mentioned here before, The Canceling of the American Mind by Greg Lukianoff and Ricky Schlott. Woo-hoo. It's a book that didn't need to have a subhead and or subtitle, but the subtitle.
But it has probably the worst subtitle in recent memory. Yep.
Cancel culture undermines trust and threatens us all. Long dash, but there is a solution. That's not a good subtitle. I read it in part to interview Greg for C-SPAN's book TV, book notes thing, which is available out there in the world on C-SPAN. Please have a look at it. And I was struck by, and of course, go and look at Nick's great interview with the two of them at a recent speakeasy recently to get more out of them from that. But I was just struck by one chapter. I mean, the book is, yes, it's about cancel culture. And part of it is just like, we told you so from Greg, because he's been talking about this for such a long time. So they documented it, and there's a lot of bullet points and case studies and all of that. But what I found kind of the takeaway to chew on was it's actually kind of about the way that we argue about stuff badly. And they put it in this way that there's this effort on broadly the left and broadly the right, different types of effort getting to the same goal, which is to wipe people out of the conversation preemptively so you don't have to actually deal with them. On the left, Greg and Ricky call this the perfect rhetorical fortress, again, not the greatest name in the world, but sort of talks about this minefield that is like thrown up for people in order to get to the point where we can platform them or not, or take seriously their arguments or not. And it's familiar to anyone, just like, oh, you sort of like create a hierarchy of who is allowed to talk about various things. And it's a way to police who gets to be in these rhetorical spaces. And it's ridiculous inherently, of course. But I'm more interested on the other side, what they call the efficient rhetorical fortress, which is the right wing version of doing this. And by efficient, they just mean it's not elaborate at all. It's just like, oh, the elite said it. It's wrong. Whatever is the anti-elite or anti-establishment or anti-academia, media, government, deep state, whatever. Okay, we like those and the people there. If you come from there, we don't have to listen to a damn word you say. And I think we are in on that sense of both sides, this sort of long, really bad moment of media consumption because of that. I think I put it like 5 or 6 years ago in a piece about Jeff Flake when he retired. It's like bouncers on one side and trolls on the other. You know, you're either policing who gets to say things constantly, policing adjectives constantly, or you're just like, okay, how can I make those people crazy? Then I will do that. And it's no way to be sophisticated in your media consumption. Anyways.
Is that a cover of Stuck in the Middle of You with You by Steeler's Wheel?
Nope.
Which goes back to Reservoir Dogs, which means we have to listen to Pulp Fiction again?
Absolutely not. Anyways, Canceling the American Mind, go do it.
Do you want to return to the golden era of ponage, when arguments were discussed in terms of the percentage of ponage that one or the other person dished out or took?
Inflicted on the noobs.
I think at this rate of post-October 7th level rhetoric, which Nick and I were talking about in the pregame, we're going to see fisking make a comeback. And I apologize to the world for whatever role I played in popularizing that word, and I'm not going to explain it. I would prefer Zisking, named after Richie Zisk.
But then if we're going back that far, we have to talk mad about Richie Hebner, who was a gravedigger in the offseason, as I knew from the little cartoon on the back of his baseball card.
That is exactly
right. I hate it here.
Sadly, Fisking is not a reference to the kingpin, Wilson Fisk, who will be returning in Marvel's Echo on Disney+.
But he's going to actually be played by Carlton Fisk.
Yes.
The great Hall of Fame baseball catcher for the White Sox and the Red Sox.
And I think this podcast, like America's fiscal health is in real trouble.
Send help, please.
Carlton Fisk should only be known as a pitch man for smokeless tobacco.
Just a pinch between your cheek and gum
gives you the true Copenhagen tobacco
pleasure. Yeah, he liked that a lot. And also, he was the original Pudge.
That's right.
As a fat catcher. Although he also, Matt, like Boog Powell, who you invoked when we basically as a way of saying hello before we started this, you look back at Carlton Fisk, really not that fat, even when he was at his fattest, you know?
He was into martial arts. He stole some bases. Anyways, Catherine, thank you all for listening. Catherine's not the person who listened. I think she's torn. Thankfully, I don't actually look at these people, but I'm pretty sure she tore off her headphones a long time ago and went and hit her head against the wall. But the rest of you listened very faithful, and thank you for that. Stay tuned for bonus episodes and just the normal weekly stuff, and get ready for the webathon semi-soon. All of our podcasts are findable at thereason.com/podcasts. Our events, we have plenty of them, are findable at reason.com/events. Nick, do you want to hype a forthcoming
for damn
event?
Sure. We're on Monday, November 27th. We're doing a global intergalactic premiere of a new documentary about Bitcoin and the slagging of its energy usage, which is way wrong. You know, Bitcoin is good for the energy economy, good for the world, but we're going to be doing that and having a panel discussion afterwards, which is going to be fantastic. That's on November 27th. Go to reason.com/events or check out the NYC events newsletter at reason.com/newsletters.
Bueno. Thank you for listening. We'll catch you next week. Goodbye.